today on Against the Grain. How did civil rights concerns become part of the mainstream liberal project in the U.S.? Did racial liberalism become aligned with the Democratic Party in the 1960s as a result of civil rights activism and presidential pronouncements? I'm C.S. Eric Schickler has written a book that runs counter to conventional narratives. He joins me, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. It hasn't always been so. The racial liberalism that we now associate with the Democratic Party has not always been a part of the liberal project in the U.S. For a long time, civil rights concerns were not on the liberal agenda. They were placed there, many believe, in the protest-filled 1960s, when President Johnson made a decisive shift to the left on race. Eric Schickler believes otherwise. Rather than seeing the 60s as the critical moment in the partisan realignment on race, Schickler claims that the process of connecting civil rights support with the liberal program began in the late 1930s, thanks to the rise of the CIO, the efforts of African-American activists, and the reaction of Southern Democrats. Eric Schickler is professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley, and his latest book is Racial Realignment, The Transformation of American Liberalism, 1932 to 1965. When Eric Schickler joined me in studio, I asked him what he meant by the civil rights realignment.
By the civil rights realignment, what I'm talking about is the narrow question of how is it that the Democrats, who had been the party of Southern racism, became the party associated with greater racial liberalism than the Republicans, who owed their origins in part to abolition of slavery and the cause of Reconstruction.
What is the standard explanation, if there is one, of when the alignment, say, of African Americans and of civil rights concerns with the Democratic Party took place?
So the standard story is that really up until the 1960s, both parties took a very similar, tepid position on civil rights. And if anything, Republicans were slightly more associated with racial liberalism than Democrats, again, because of the Southern racists in the party. And it's really in the 1960s that this was transformed.
And I imagine the civil rights movement and all that activism plays a major part in this conventional view, a major causal role in pushing the Democratic Party in the direction of civil rights.
It does, though there's a kind of curiosity in the political science literature on this, which it sees the civil rights movement as a kind of precipitating factor. They're the ones who forced it onto the agenda, but really it gives quite a lot of agency to Lyndon Johnson and Barry Goldwater as deciding how to respond to that pressure, so that the real causal agents, the real people that are highlighted in terms of the realignment part of the story, are national leaders of the Democratic and Republican parties.
So you have a kind of historical analysis. You go back much earlier in U.S. history. In fact, you go back to the New Deal. And we're going to talk about this in a lot of detail over the course of this hour, but is it your basic argument that there were much earlier developments that tended to align civil rights with the mainstream democratic liberal program?
Yes. So the argument of the book at its core is that it's in the mid-1930s and late 1930s that the idea of civil rights really becomes associated with the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. And the story in the book is largely one of how that commitment gradually redefined the primary ideological dimension and political dimension in American politics, with much of the work doing that happening in the late 1930s and 1940s, owing to a coalition of labor unionists, African-American activists, and self-identified liberals within the Democratic Party.
So we're talking about the FDR years. To what extent was Roosevelt in his early years in power? To what extent was he interested in or even a leader on civil rights issues.
So this is one of the points that I think much of the literature does get correct, which is that Roosevelt, while you know, a great president in many dimensions, when it came to issues of race, was really not a leader in terms of the liberal cause. It was not a priority for him. He focused to a large extent on placating the Southern conservatives that he saw as essential to pass his programs. So in that sense, I think this conventional or contemporary understanding of Roosevelt as a laggard is right. And that does tend to fit in with this idea of, well, it must have been leaders later on. I think one thing that this depiction of Roosevelt misses, though, is that he wasn't alone in being a laggard in the mid-1930s. If one looks at what other self-identified white liberals in the Democratic Party were saying, vast majority of them, when the New Deal started, did not see race as part of their agenda. And so one of the striking things I've learned is that when liberals were criticizing Roosevelt as being too tepid, not sufficiently liberal, they attacked him for lots of things, being not ardent enough about labor rights, about regulating business, about Wall Street, but they almost never criticized him on issues of race, at least when it comes to white liberals. They didn't do that in 1933. And a core argument of the book is that that had changed by the time we get to World War II.
So in other words, the New Deal was not conceived by FDR as being a kind of leftist force in the arena of race and racial justice?
Exactly. It was not conceived by him as a leftist force in terms of race. And just as importantly, the other contributors to forming the New Deal at the start, think about magazines like The Nation and The New Republic. Think about leading social reformers out in politics. At least among white liberals in that group, they also didn't see race as a core part of the liberal project.
What about Southern Democrats in Congress? You spend a fair amount of this book talking about Democratic senators and congresspeople from the U.S. South in the 1930s and then on up into the 1960s. What did Southern Democrats in the 1930s, how did they feel about the New Deal and the kind of the mainstream liberal program that was being advanced by the Roosevelt administration?
I think at the start of the New Deal, Southern Democrats were widely seen as among the strongest supporters of the program. The South was devastated by the Depression, deeply impoverished, and saw itself as benefiting from government spending, government programs to push for recovery. And so on those earliest programs, the South generally was supportive, with the caveat that whenever they thought it would touch on issues of race, they would work to exclude African Americans essentially from the benefits, and therefore, in that sense, solidify their control of power in the economy in their region.
And this is a reflection of their white supremacist views, right? And also their understanding that to allow blacks to gain more influence and power in the South might hurt their interests.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the preservation of white supremacy and of a low-wage agricultural economy are core commitments for most Southern Democrats in Congress during this period, you know, who were elected, of course, by a shrunken electorate in which blacks could not vote, in which many poor people could not vote. And they saw keeping that status quo in place as essential for both their economic and political survival.
So you point in this book, Racial Realignment, to a number of key developments in broadening the liberal program to include civil rights. And one of these, and one that I'd like to spend a lot of time on, was what you call the meteoric rise of the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. Tell us a little bit about the origins of the CIO. I think it was founded in 1935, and about its leaders.
Sure. So the CIO really grew out of a reaction against the approach of the old AFL, which dominated American labor up to this period.
American Federation of Labor.
Right. And tended to organize workers by craft rather than by industry. And the AFL tended to be a relatively conservative union. The craft organization is itself, you know, the model of apprenticeship and training is really premised in a lot of ways on excluding, limiting the supply of labor. And they tended to shy away from organizing unskilled workers in new rising industries. And what the CIO represented was a reaction against that, where the effort now was, with the rise of mass production and mass industry, trying to organize the workers industry by industry rather than craft by craft. But once you start organizing mass production industries, you know, the problem of strike breaking becomes much different than it is in a craft where you had to go through this apprenticeship.
Were African Americans seen as potential strike breakers?
Yeah, in part because African Americans were, you know, the victims of so much exclusion and discrimination. When, you know, you can, one way to think about it is the most vulnerable workers are the ones who are going to be most responsive when there is that opportunity. And so oftentimes companies would bring in African-American workers as strike breakers. And given that African-Americans saw themselves as rightly as excluded from the labor movement, that was something that often happened, leading to racial conflict as well as class conflict.
Eric Schickler is my guest in studio. He's professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley, and he's author of Racial Realignment, The Transformation of American Liberalism, 1932 to 1965, recently out from Princeton University Press. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, what about African Americans working in industries that the CIO either were a part of or wanted to enter? Was it important in that sense for the CIO to recruit African-American workers so that they would join the CIO and become part of the constituency?
Yeah, exactly. So from the start, I think it's fair to say that the CIO had both pragmatic and principled reasons to want to organize African-American workers and try to be more racially egalitarian than the AFL. Pragmatically, in a lot of these industries, there was an incentive to organize African-American workers to prevent strike breaking and broaden the base of the union. And so if you think about a case like autos or steel, for example, finding ways to appeal to African-Americans and incorporate them was a part of the union strategy pragmatically, really from the start. And actually going back even a little further, the United Mine Workers, which was one of the first components of the CIO, had a tradition of organizing biracially from quite early on. So I think one major motivation is this pragmatic one, that to succeed in a mass production industry, you needed to show that you're going to be inclusive rather than exclusive.
And you were saying the AFL was about organizing craft workers, more skilled workers. So what was the record of the AFL on race? And before the CIO's rise, to what extent was the labor movement in the U.S. identified with racial justice, with civil rights?
Right. So this AFL record on race, I think it's fair to say, ranged from mediocre to poor, with probably more on in terms of poor. And the reason I say there's a range is each local did differ. You know, so there's not uniformity across AFL unions, but many of them practiced segregation. In other words, included clauses that either de facto or officially excluded African Americans from joining the union. And then they would form what they would say is, well, we can form segregated separate unions. And so that's obviously creating a context in which African Americans are going to be placed at a substantial disadvantage. Just to give an example of how outside the civil rights orbit the AFL was, in 1934, the NAACP sponsored a major drive to pass anti-lynching legislation, and they collected literally hundreds of signatures urging Roosevelt to push the lynching bill through Congress when it was being filibustered. And when you look at who signed that petition, it's wide range of people all over from different professions, backgrounds, and so on. What you don't see is any labor leaders on that. And that, I think, is indicative of the fact that the NAACP, as they're looking around for allies, don't see organized labor at that moment as an ally.
So with the rise of the CIO, you claim in this book that there was a growing connection made, a high-profile connection made between racial liberalism, between issues of racial equality and justice, and the liberalism of the New Deal, the economic and other liberalism of the New Deal. How important were CIO activists who emerged from the communist and socialist parties in the U.S.? How important were they in pushing the CIO to embrace racial equality?
I think they were important, and that in some sense goes to the principled side of things. I talked about the pragmatic incentive, but I think it's fair to say that within the Socialist Party at that time and the Communist Party, there was growing recognition of the importance of issues of race, and that it is the case that a lot of the activists and organizers who were most committed on this, on the issues of racial equality, did come out of that tradition. In some cases communist, in other cases social democratic. The Reuther brothers in Detroit, as an example, came out of that socialist and social democratic movements, and they had a commitment early on in their careers, at least to racial liberalism, that set them apart from the old leaders of the UAW at the time. One way to think about it is if you look across CIO unions, the ones that tended to take the strongest positions on issues of race often had a strong presence of left-wing activists in their ranks.
Now, if a union, a large union organization, begins to think in terms of race and racial justice and makes it a priority, one option is it could confine its advocacy on the issue of race to the workplace, right? To what union members are doing, in this case, biracial organizing and non-discrimination within the union. Is that what the CIO confined its activities to?
One of the striking things is that they went much broader than that pretty early on. So, for example, if you look at the earliest issues of the CIO News, they would talk about the priority issues in Congress, and they would talk actually about anti-lynching legislation. They'd talk about banning the poll tax, about enfranchising poor white and black workers. They would say it as workers in the South, but it's about their voting rights, not just their workplace rights, that they were worried about. So I think they did early on take on this broader agenda. And in fact, the way they would put it is that labor rights are a civil right. And I think in framing it that way, that kind of incorporates a range of concerns. It's a way to think about workplace rights that broadens your lens rather than just narrowing it.
So, Eric, you were saying that, you know, early on FDR was not interested in civil rights issues. The New Deal wasn't conceived as some sort of a radical force for racial equality. So the CIO must of course have known this, and so they're interested, as you say, in national issues, in policy issues. What happened with CIO, leaders in terms of trying to influence FDR and trying to have him and other Democrats on the national level try to link racial issues with the mainstream liberal Democratic program?
So I think one important point to make is that the CIO didn't see itself as simply a captive of the Democratic Party. They saw themselves as pushing a broad ideological liberal agenda, which they made clear really from the start that the Democratic Party is one possible vehicle for that. But if the party doesn't become a truly liberal party, they're open to alternatives. And so the way I would think about it is that the CIO tried to lay out a broad-ranging liberal program with civil rights as part of it, though not the only part, and then tried to work as hard as they could to nominate candidates for office who adhered to that agenda, and sending a message to the Democratic Party, hey, we are the muscle in this party in terms of organizing voters, turning people out, and so you need to take our views seriously, otherwise we may exit.
So then what can we say about when the New Deal and when New Dealers began to be identified with the racial project of the CIO, and what kind of impact did that have kind of on the political scene?
I don't think it happens all at once, but I think it does happen within a short number of years. And part of this is you need to think about the rise of the CIO also in terms of having that impact in relation to what's going on with African-American voters in the North and also what's going on with Southern Democrats in response to the CIO. I really think of that constellation of developments, which I argue happened in the mid to late 1930s, as together forging this liberal coalition and liberal identity that then gradually takes over the party. It's clear by 1938 the CIO is a force to be reckoned within the Democratic Party, in part because there's a ton of energy with the CIO, big gains in unionization in this period, and they become this highly controversial symbol by 1937, 1938. When they launch the sit-down strikes at the very end of 1936 and throughout 37, you know, this is just such a radical change in practice in America. The idea of workers sitting down and taking over a factory is just, you know, unheard of. And what's even more unheard of is the federal government not going in, or the state government not going in and, you know, violently repressing that action. Instead, very controversially, the governor of Michigan and Roosevelt did not use force, and the strikers were successful. And that just sent a tremendous message. And part of that message was to workers about their potential power, but part of that message was also to people on the right about the threat to order that the CIO represented. This was especially powerful in the South, but it was also powerful among Republicans in the North. And I think that reaction against the CIO, that effort to fight back against the CIO and limit it, ironically helped make it in some sense a more important political symbol, make its advocate. The fact that the most controversial, the most energized advocates for a strong reading of the New Deal were opposed by the Southern racists, essentially, helped with fusing the cause of race to the liberal project.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Eric Schickler teaches political science at UC Berkeley. He's written and co-written a number of books, including Investigating the President, Congressional Checks on Presidential Power, and Disjointed Pluralism, Institutional Innovation and the Development of the U.S. Congress. We are talking about his latest book. It's called Racial Realignment, The Transformation of American Liberalism, 1932 to 1965. So, right, as you were saying, there were other factors at work. It wasn't just the rise of the CIO that put race on the liberal agenda, so to speak. And if we turn to what African Americans were doing at the time and African American activists were doing at the time, it seems to me that for the CIO to recruit and appeal to African American workers, it probably had to overcome a great deal of skepticism among blacks toward the labor movement. How deep was this skepticism?
Yeah, the skepticism toward labor was quite deep, and one can track what was happening, at least among elites in the African-American community, by reading coverage in Crisis, which was the NAACP's, you know, journal, as well as black newspapers. And what you see is initial interest in the CIO, where people are saying, wow, this is something different, but at the same time, a kind of skepticism saying, well, let's see them actually deliver. When they're actually organizing workers, let's see them live up to this biracial organizing and equal treatment that they're telling us they're going to do. But one of the striking things is, as you follow those newspapers forward a couple years, by 1937, 38, you're seeing them cover the CIO extensively and quite favorably, really noting that this is a change in practice for the labor movement. We are seeing something different on the ground. And part of this was because the CIO itself actively reached out to African-American organizations and activists. So, for example, the National Negro Congress, which was the more militant rival to the NAACP that emerged in the mid-1930s, they became allies with the CIO early on and worked together on some of the most important organizing campaigns, such as in Steele.
And what was happening within the ranks of the NAACP, maybe in terms of more radical members, as far as perhaps pressuring the leadership of the NAACP to make alliances with the CIO?
Yeah, no, there's a fascinating story there where within the NAACP, there was a kind of laboristic, more lefty faction. W.E.B. Du Bois is one of them, and there are also younger African-American leaders who are associated with that wing. But up until the late 1930s, they're really losing out to the more traditionalist, more conservative, moderate leadership who are pushing for trying to be able to appeal to white businessmen, for example, and doing that by not emphasizing issues of labor and kind of left-wing politics. And what you see happen with the rise of the CIO is they become a viable partner for these young radicals, and the CIO starts to show appeal among young African-Americans in major cities. You see the NAACP gradually move away from that more moderate conservative stance and actually become allies with the CIO and embrace this idea that, you know, union rights, labor rights are actually part of a civil rights campaign as well.
Now, it's natural, of course, for organizations like the NAACP to embrace a program of racial liberalism and racial equality. What about economic liberalism? To what extent did Black leaders and organizations also decide to throw their weight behind the economic liberalism, for example, of the New Deal?
So the reaction to the New Deal is quite interesting. If you read Black press coverage of the New Deal, early on, there's a lot of criticism about the exclusions of African Americans from New Deal programs. This is something the white press, the little surprise, was ignoring. You'll find very little coverage of that. But when you read the Black press, there's acute awareness of the ways in which the New Deal is not providing fair benefits. However, at the same time, even those publications are essentially saying that the solution is not to repeal the New Deal, but is to extend its reach. And so there's criticism and there's concern about whether FDR is really going to prove to be an ally or not, and the New Deal an ally or not. But the general response is that what we need is a more forthright kind of liberalism at that point. The kind of blind spot initially, though, before you have the CIO, is issues of labor and union rights. That was something in which the Black press was quite ambivalent about at first. And I think that's partially due to the exclusion of African Americans from unions and partially due to the, you know, potentially the economic position of the elites who are running these newspapers and so on. But over time, with the rise of the CIO as a potential ally for African Americans, you really do see most of these newspapers, most of these elites shifting toward a more consistent liberalism, I would say, in which labor, in particular, the CIO is seen as a real ally.
You indicate in your book that the racial liberalism of most CIO leaders and many of its organizers, in some cases, contrasted with racial attitudes among rank and file workers.
Yeah, I mean, the enduring problem for the labor movement, you know, you can see the roots there, is that, you know, rank and file workers, particularly when it comes to issues of social mixing, close social contact, imbued much of the racism that's endemic to American society. I think there's a little bit of a tendency, unfairly, to say, oh, these union workers were particularly racist. It's actually the case, if you look at the early opinion data, that compared to other whites, you know, on many issues, they're a little bit less racist, but, you know, they still have deep prejudice. But that created a challenge for the labor leaders and organizers to try to keep them on board for this agenda. And one of the striking things when you read the CIO news is that it really stands out as probably the only prominent, you know, white-led publication to really routinely do things like show pictures, photos of African-American and white kids swimming together, playing together, going to summer camp together, and I think really trying to send the message to the membership that, you know, we really have to see African Americans as part of our project, as part of our group, and rather than as a separate outgroup.
That's Eric Schickler. He is professor of political science at UC Berkeley. We are talking about his book, Racial Realignment, The Transformation of American Liberalism, 1932 to 1965. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Eric about his really interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Eric Schickler is my guest. He is a political science professor at the University of California, Berkeley. And he has authored a book called Racial Realignment. So the World War II. World War II plays an important part in your story. And it had an effect on African Americans, of course. Many African Americans moved north to work in wartime industry. Then, of course, you had African-American soldiers returning from the war. What happened during World War II to the power, the potential power of African-Americans and African-American voters?
So African-American voters start to enter the Democratic Party in good numbers a little bit before World War II. They vote for Roosevelt decisively in 1936. And in contrast with a lot of white voters, they keep voting for Roosevelt and the Democrats in 1938, 1940. So they're starting to come into the party, but before World War II, the sheer numbers of African Americans in the North is relatively modest in most cities and most states. And migration in World War II just brought, you know, tremendous increase in the voting power of African Americans. So the sheer number of Democratic politicians with a personal incentive to try to woo African American voters goes up substantially. So that's certainly one major impact of the war. Another has to do with just the mobilization within the African American community that actually starts in the lead up to the war. And I think one of the most important events in this forging of this new liberalism owes its origins to A. Philip Randolph, who is an African American activist, and in the lead up to the mobilization for the war, really pressured Roosevelt to create a Fair Employment Practices Commission to police discrimination in the workplace. And the way he did this was with the threat of a massive march on Washington. So this is the first March on Washington movement actually happens, you know, 20-some years before the more famous one we know about today or read about more today. And that threat, which led Roosevelt to create, you know, really take his first proactive civil rights action, which was creating this FEPC. And that, creating this commission, became a kind of rallying cry, an organizing tool for liberal activists to push for further civil rights reform. And the way I would think about that is that it put civil rights on the national political agenda in a way that it hadn't been before, because what liberals pushed for starting with the creation of FEPC is to give it more enforcement power and to make it permanent. And that really dominated the deliberations for about a decade and became a kind of core element of the liberal program.
The FEPC being the Fair Employment Practices Committee. What did World War II do to African-American leaders and activists in terms of the claims they could and they did make for racial equality in the U.S.?
So early on, African-American activists and newspapers, the Pittsburgh Courier being a kind of key example, really saw the war as a chance for what they called the Double V campaign. Victory, you know, if we're fighting fascism abroad and fighting for democracy abroad, we really need to think about the quality of our democracy at home. And so this Double V campaign was a way to, on the one hand, be patriotic and nationalistic, and yet on the other hand, you know, work to leverage the rhetoric of the war to fight for justice at home.
And some African Americans, of course, made a very sharp argument, right, about the hypocrisy of the U.S. in fighting for freedom abroad while Jim Crow conditions still existed within.
Yeah, no, the argument of hypocrisy was put forward, you know, in strong terms by African American leaders. And the striking thing is that this is the first time during World War II where you actually start to see white liberals kind of echoing those arguments or embracing those arguments. So, for example, after the really terrible race riots in Detroit in 1943, New Republic and the Nation, sort of leaders of liberal opinion, really are critical of Roosevelt for his failure to lead on this issue, the failure to take on discrimination at home, and to say in the context of this war, you know, the idea of, you know, of these kinds of race riots where whites are essentially killing African Americans, beating up African Americans for trying to move into integrated neighborhoods, that just sends such a terror, you know, that the symbolism of that while fighting the Nazis is just so horrific that he's failed as a leader, not just a domestic leader, but as a wartime leader. And so this was an argument African Americans make during the war, and that I think actually resonated with a fair number of white liberals.
What impact did World War II have on the labor movement and on the CIO's membership?
So World War II, on balance, was quite beneficial for the CIO, because just the sheer number of members of unions explodes during World War II. And so just the resources of the CIO grow. There is controversy about how radical to be during the war. So, for example, there's controversy over a no-strike pledge. So I don't want to say that there aren't divisions, but I think in terms of making labor unions a much more powerful force in American politics, on balance, the war, you know, contributed to organized labor's influence.
You talked about the CIO eventually making very strong alliances with the Democratic Party because they realized that New Deal liberals would, in fact, back the racial program. What about African-American activists like A. Philip Randolph? Was he focused on helping the Democratic Party?
So the argument I make in the book is that you need to think about African-American, you know, voters and activists on a couple different levels, and because I think they play a critical role in the early part of this story in a couple of distinct ways. So one is in terms of just rank-and-file voters and citizens. I think African-Americans, when you look at their political views, tended to be quite economically liberal, as one might expect, given their kind of social and economic position. And so they're predisposed to, you know, vote for the liberal or the Democrat, you know, and therefore the Democratic Party on economic issues. So they start to become a constituency in that way, and therefore start to acquire at least a little bit of power or influence within the party by that predisposition. But I think really analytically separate from that, you have civil rights activists like Randolph, whose project is, you know, essentially racial equality. And he doesn't care whether this is going to help the Democratic Party or hurt the Democratic Party. He's going to try to push that issue onto the agenda. And I think the really crucial kind of analytic point is what happens when these two different dimensions intersect. You know, when activists are pushing something onto the agenda, who's going to have an incentive to respond? And it's really because of the changes on this other, what I like to think of as timeline or trajectory, where the CIO and African-American voters have entered the Democratic coalition, that's what predisposes Democratic politicians to be the ones who respond when these movement activists force the issue onto the agenda. So, you know, Randolph is happy whoever is going to back FEPC, but the people who are going to back it are the ones whose constituents are pushing for the racially liberal position. And because of the movement among African-American voters and because of the CIO, those are going to be Democratic politicians rather than Republicans.
His name is Eric Schickler. He is author of Racial Realignment, The Transformation of American Liberalism, 1932 to 1965. We have a link on againstthegrain.org to his book, as well as to his faculty page at the University of California, Berkeley, where he teaches political science. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, you know, you have this rise of the CIO. They become very influential with the Roosevelt administration. And then you have the Southern Democrats who, as we've mentioned, wanted to protect their own interests and were not interested in racial justice and racial equality. So how did they react to the rise of the CIO and to, you know, the synergy created by African Americans and their activists and leaders joining a kind of liberal coalition? How did the Southern Democrats react to this?
So the Southern Democrats reacted with great hostility and panic to the rise of the CIO and the entry of African-American voters. They really saw the idea of the CIO organizing biracially in the South as a mortal threat, and they worried about the CIO basically liberalizing the National Democratic Party on issues of race. So they start to fight the CIO from really early on. They investigate it in Congress. They target it with anti-labor legislation working with Republicans, and they turn against the New Deal liberal project in general because they see it as linked to the CIO and African-American project of transforming the Democratic Party and eventually the South. And I think that development, this Southern shift, is crucial because what it means is that now for liberals to succeed, they need to defeat the Southern Democrats. And if you think about it from African Americans' perspective, they're no longer what I would call isolated claimants in the party. In other words, their interest in defeating the Southerners is now the same interest as the CIO's interest and other liberals in defeating the Southerners. They're a common enemy for the liberal project as a whole. And so as a result, that I think just greatly increases the leverage of African Americans and helps form the understanding that the liberal project involves racial liberalism, labor liberalism, and defeating these Southern reactionaries, the Southern Tories, as the CIO referred to them.
So we have a lot of energy devoted to the racial project. We have the rise of the CIO. We have African-American organizations. We have black voters. We have black constituencies. And then the question becomes, what happened over, let's say, the 1940s and the 1950s leading into the turbulent 1960s? So to what extent, for example, were national party leaders, National Democratic Party leaders, affected and influenced by what might be seen as this sort of groundswell of action from below? To what extent were they responsive to that and shifted their opinions on race issues as a result?
My argument in the book is that national leaders in general were more slow and hesitant to respond than were leaders at the state and local level. And the reason is the national leaders had an incentive to try to keep the Southerners on board. And so in most cases, they tried to moderate and straddle and avoid the issue. There's some exceptions, but that was the general thrust. Instead, what happened was these activists were essentially able to capture the party from below by winning over state parties, which had less to worry about, you know, satisfying the Southerners, and also winning over local members of Congress. Each member of Congress has their own constituency that they care most about responding to, and they're less invested in the national party's calculus. And so the argument I make is in the 1940s and 1950s, this movement essentially took over the Democratic Party from below.
What do you write in this book about Northern whites, Northern white voters, and shifts within that constituency in the 40s and 50s?
Yeah, so I argue in the book that while Northern white Democrats are about as prejudiced as Northern white Republicans, they're maybe a little less prejudiced, that you see a real shift in terms of their policy views, their willingness to use the government to address racial discrimination. I argue that starting actually in the late 1930s, Northern white Democrats, especially Northern white economically liberal Democrats, are much more supportive of the kind of core policy changes that would be needed to enforce civil rights, such as protections against job discrimination, such as a ban against the poll tax so African Americans could vote. Whereas economically conservative Republicans in the North were much more opposed to those programs.
Is there a moment at which National Democratic Party leaders were finally persuaded to really take a strong stand on racial issues? And if there is a period of time, you know, what happened at that point?
Yeah, no, I think that it's a gradual process. I mean, we see hints of it. It certainly starts with Truman, who does, you know, in 1948, take some important steps. Though what's striking is even Truman himself kind of backs off in important ways. Then you see it actually in the late 1950s, you start to see movements where the chair of the Democratic National Committee, Paul Butler, after Eisenhower's win in 1956 and seeing the rising pressure of the Montgomery bus boycott and civil rights activism, starts to say things like, wow, we can't be the party of segregation. We really need, you know, these Southern segregationists are not our party, and trying to move the party to the left. If you look in 1960 at the control of the Democratic platform, that's the first time nationally where the liberal forces had control. And so I guess I would identify all those moments, but it's really, the way I would see it is that national leaders are going to hold out as long as they can, and that it's really the intense civil rights activism movement activism in the early 60s that forces even Kennedy very hesitantly and then finally Johnson to take a clear stand. And so I think that, you know, the conventional narrative about Johnson is right in the sense that he does take these actions in the mid-1960s, and they are important. But the way I would see it is that his hand is really forced by these changes that had happened below him in the party. And so that when movement activists force a decision to happen, he's leading a party that had already been redefined essentially below him. It's not to say he had no choice at all, but the incentives pushing him toward embracing what most of his party had already embraced were quite strong.
And specifically, what were they afraid of if they did not, in fact, begin to align their racial views with the lower levels of the party and with the civil rights movement?
I think for Johnson, it was clear to him that his chances of holding on to the Democratic nomination in 1964, the main threat to it was a challenge from the left, whether it's from Bobby Kennedy or someone else. But that was his fear. And if you look at his conversations with his advisors, he would say things like, I need the liberals to support me, and the only way I can do that is to out-liberal Kennedy on civil rights. If I show any weakness on civil rights, I'm not going to be seen as a liberal, and I'm vulnerable. And again, and I view that as a testament to all the work that had gone on over the previous two decades in defining civil rights as this core liberal commitment. That's why Johnson's hand is forced in that situation.
Eric Schickler joins us. He's professor of political science at UC Berkeley, and we're talking about his book, Racial Realignment. So some listeners have no doubt joined this program kind of in midstream. You know, we began the hour talking about kind of the standard explanation of when the alignment of African Americans and of civil rights concerns with the Democratic Party, when that first took place. And, you know, you were telling me about how a standard academic explanation is that National Party elites in the 1960s were the decisive factor, and you want to go back to the New Deal era. So can you just sum up the main argument of your book for those people who might have missed the beginning?
Sure. I'd say the main argument of the book is that when the New Deal started in the early 1930s, race was not part of the liberal project. But the rise of the CIO with its racially egalitarian positions, the entry of African Americans into the Democratic Party in the mid-1930s and 40s, and the Southern reaction against both of those forces really led to a redefinition of liberalism where racial equality became part of the liberal project, seen as a core for its success, and that essentially what happened is gradually over time, that took over the Democratic Party from below, with civil rights movement activists playing an especially important role in putting issues onto the agenda to try to crystallize this new dimension. You know, by forcing decisions, forcing discussion of civil rights, they're raising its salience and allowing this new coalition, in a sense, to become crystallized and solidified.
What are the implications of this civil rights realignment for today's politics?
So I view the civil rights realignment as really the starting point for today's polarized politics that we have and the red-blue map that we see today. If you think about a whole series of issues that have become partisan, polarized issues, whether it's about guns, abortion, gay rights, feminism, and so on, in each case, what we see is the kind of more rural, traditionalist South aligning with the Republicans. And I think it's wrong to see that as just a kind of coincidence. I think that by redefining the Democratic Party, by essentially taking those Southern conservatives gradually out of the party, that allowed the Democrats to become a more thoroughgoing liberal party, and it allowed the Republicans to be, or led the Republicans to become a more Southern, rural, conservative party. And so on issue after issue, we see this alignment of kind of moral traditionalism, cultural conservatism, and republicanism that just wasn't there before when, you know, you had all those same kinds of voters were part of the Democratic Party. So instead of a kind of cross-cutting politics, we have one where you get these reinforcing cleavages that has I think, produced this, you know, highly polarized red-blue map where, you know, geography defines so much of our politics.
Can we say anything about kind of what happened to the Southern Democrats who became so hostile to the CIO and organized labor and racial issues and where the Democratic Party was going and where the New Deal was heading? What happened to them in the sense of, I mean, were these eventually to become the Republicans, the Southern Republicans in later decades?
Eventually they do. I mean, one thing that is striking is how long they're able to hold on. And I think the localistic aspect, the local element of American elections, the decentralization, the positive is it's what allowed liberals to capture the Northern Democratic Party, the fact that these members of Congress could worry just about their own constituents rather than the national party. But at the same time, it's what allowed these Southern racist conservatives to stay in power for decades, even as much of the rest of the party was changing. Eventually, what you see happen once the national party is so clearly defined on as the racially liberal party is that these Southerners essentially either die out or become Republicans, or replaced by Republicans who take a consistently conservative position. So it's a kind of gradual disappearance of these Southern conservatives that, you know, by the 1980s and 90s had become almost complete.
Eric Schickler, professor of political science at UC Berkeley. His books include Partisan Hearts and Minds and Filibuster, Obstruction and Lawmaking in the U.S. Senate. And we've been talking about his latest book. It's called Racial Realignment, The Transformation of American Liberalism, 1932 to 1965. Again, we have links to that book on againstthegrain.org. Eric, thanks so much for joining me and talking about your book.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.